Bonjour, bonjour, bonjour. Welcome to the SBS Cycling Podcast. Today, I've got a special guest with me. It's Tiff Cromwell. Tiffany, how are you? All the way from sunny, not sunny Europe, I guess. So, but not too bad.
Sunny Europe, sunny south of France right now. Sunny Monaco.
Morning. How are you in, how's your French, first of all? Comment ça va?
Comme ci, comme ça. No, it's okay, to be honest. I should be fluent by now. I've lived in this region since 2011. But yeah, I'm still not fluent. Too many expats where I'm not forced to speak the language.
And don't worry, I'm not pushing you into French. Don't worry, that's okay. Let's talk about you. Big big race coming up. Big start of the year as well for you. You were in Australia at the very beginning in the summer of cycling. First of all, how was it to be back in Australia for you?
Yeah, it was great to be back in Australia. You know, it's the first time I was racing there since 2020, because obviously the 2 years of COVID and then the years after our team, my Canyon Tram team, wasn't racing. So, you know, I was excited to be back on home roads and obviously with family and friends and, you know, starting with the Nationals and then Tour Down Under, which, you know, I'm from Adelaide. It's a road I've grown up on. And so that was quite special. And then continuing on with Cadells. So. And then I got 6 weeks in Australia in total, which these days is really long. I really enjoyed it. And, you know, they're all amazing races. And, yeah, it's great to have World Tour racing on home soil.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something we'll talk about, actually, because you've also helped develop some of the racing here with the Radl Gravel and that gravel scenes, some sort of the things I want to touch on in this podcast today. But first of all, in terms of the – did you see a difference in the way the Tour Down Under has been handled and been raced before the COVID and after the COVID? There's been a few changes, of course. There's been a lot of different sort of approach in the race. Is it a new beginning? What's the feeling in the peloton for the Tour Down Under?
Yeah, I think for the Tour Down Under, if I'm talking only on the women's side, you know, before COVID, we weren't a World Tour race. It was still a new race for the women. You know, not many teams came out to it just because obviously the travel, the cost and everything else, it just didn't make sense. So, you know, it's still taking time to get like a full World Tour field because on the women's side, you know, it's not compulsory to do every single World Tour race. But you could see even from last year to this year, I think last year there was only a handful of women's World Tour teams. And this year we already had, I can't remember the exact amount, but, you know, an increase in numbers, like obviously with Canyon Tram included and, you know, a few other teams. And I feel like every year the level's getting higher. You know, we've got Stewie who heads the race, O'Grady, and then you got Nettie Edmondson and Carly Taylor, both are former pro riders who have, you know, come on board and, you know, they understand what women's cycling needs. And, you know, we've been given the platform, like, yeah, it's only a 3 day race, but, you know, it's 3 days of our own race. It's not overlapping with the men. You know, we've seen huge crowds, like from even before to now. We got, you know, we're starting in the center of towns, whereas before, you know, we were like, okay, we start in Harndorf, but we're actually at the oval where nobody can find, you know, these sorts of things, which is where we're seeing the progression. You know, Australia has been at the forefront of pushing more for equality and the balance between men and women, which obviously it's really cool. But yeah, I'd say those are the main ones. You know, the level of the race obviously within is high, but even the support around it's been stepping up year by year, and they're obviously putting more money behind it, which, you know, it's what we want for women's cycling.
Yeah, and then, of course, you've added your pierre de l'édifice, as we say in French. You added your little touch with the Radl Gravel. How was it important for you to do your own bit, and something that you, I assume from what I've read, you're fairly interested in gravel, the way the gravel scene is going, is something you've been enjoying a little bit off, and then probably something that you wanted to just add your touch to it.
Yeah, definitely. Like the opportunity to be able to create a gravel race in Adelaide as part of Tour Down Under came up about halfway through last year. Carly Taylor reached out to me and she was like, yeah, we want to create, you know, a gravel event within the Tour Down Under festivities. And for me, so if we would work back a little bit, so Amy Charity, who runs SBT Gravel in Colorado, it's probably one of the biggest gravel races in the world right now. I'd gone there with Valtteri, my partner, and then we were talking about, and then she saw an interview that Valtteri said about, you know, wanting to do a gravel race in his hometown. And then conversation started, then we partnered up as the three of us to create a gravel race in Finland. And, you know, it went really well, same with the blueprint that had SBT, which it's not just about the race, it's about the whole festivity as well. And then we did Finland Gravel. And, you know, my dream was always to come to Adelaide, do one, obviously, in my hometown. And, you know, the gravel is amazing there. And it's, I'm doing gravel kind of 50-50 with the road these days. And, you know, it's a discipline that's growing like crazy. The participation rate is high. You know, it's not only for pros, it's super accessible. So when obviously this opportunity came, I jumped on it. Like, it was maybe a touch earlier than what we had planned on our personal timeline within our gravel company. But yeah, I was like, well, it's an amazing opportunity. We'll do it as like a test event kind of to start with. And then, you know, the goal is to grow up like much bigger already in 25 and then beyond. So it kind of went from there, you know. It's, I'm fortunate that we have an amazing team behind the scenes who does a lot of like the heavy lifting. So, you know, Valtteri and I don't have to be so involved because naturally, like, we're both very busy with our day jobs. But, you know, to be a part of it, to bring gravel to Adelaide and, you know, to create such an event, to have the support by Santos Tour Down Under as well, it was exciting, you know. And
yeah,
we knew it would be, people would like it, but it was like selling the idea because I think people didn't really understand. Like, they know what going to a race and just doing the race, but not understanding, you know, we do events beforehand, like creating a community, like doing all this other stuff. And when people really saw that, you could see like everyone enjoyed it. And
yeah, kind that's
of happy.
But that's a very good point, actually. Something Makai and I, we've talked about how, and we debated a lot about how gravel is changing the vision of cycling amongst everyone. And of course, it brings the public to it in terms of on site. But this ability to race within the race and race with, like, I could join the race if I wanted to, you know, anyone can almost join if he's got the guts to. That mixity, is that something that for you, it's something that you also enjoy in the gravel scene?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when I first started doing gravel racing, then it was when it wasn't the level that it is now, but it was kind of like, it was my disconnect from the world tour. You know, these days the level's so high, like it's not stressful, but you know, it's like you're on, it's like, it's very serious. You know, you don't really engage. Like, you engage with the fan, you still have your little pro bubble, let's say. Whereas when I went to gravel like the first times, it was kind of like relaxing and fun. Like, I was there more to represent the sponsors to start with, and then of course race. But yeah, you know, you hang out with everyone, you know, you can have a beer, you can do all these like community rides beforehand, and it's just nice. Like, you know, it is always nice to meet other passionate people who enjoy riding bikes just for fun or for a living. And yes, when we're on the start line, we're all on race mode, and particularly, let's say, on the pro category, like, we're there to race, and naturally it splits very quickly. But it is cool when you hear all the different stories afterwards. You know, people are there just to challenge themselves. Or, like, I remember last year when we were at SBT, there was this guy, and, you know, his challenge was just to complete the course. He was the last one who finished the line, but you could just see, like, just how much it meant to him just to finish the race, you know. And that's what's, I think, quite nice with gravel, because you hear all these amazing stories and it kind of puts cycling into perspective of how it brings joy to everybody, like, across everything. So I think that's what's nice with gravel. Like, yes, it is changing now that UCI have come in. Now there's World Series, now there's World Championships, but there still is that heart in it. You know, like, some events are still trying to keep the core of gravel. If it's about community and it's about racing hard, but also just enjoying racing bikes or riding bikes.
It's very much like, if I put it into perspective, or my own perspective, is very much what running was when he sort of really took off. You could have the elite at the front, but anyone else could also join and sort of participate to its own pace and just want to join in, and being a sort of kermesse out of it, a festival out of it. It's not just about the performance. It's also about the taking part. It's like what road cycling, professional road cycling isn't, but it sort of gives you a glimpse of what it can be.
Yeah, exactly. You know, this is exactly what you say. Like, it's just like a marathon or, you know, even Ironman. Like, you have, I don't know if they have a separate start because I don't follow it. But, you know, like, you have the pros and you have all the amateurs as well. And it is, like, there's not many sports you can actually rub shoulders, like, with top professionals. You know, you can't go on a soccer pitch and go kick a ball with David Beckham, but you can ride a bike next to your favorite professional cyclist. So I think this is what's nice. And, yeah, as we say, road cycling, unless you're doing certain events, then you kind of can interact. But, you know, on, like, the World Tour side, no, it's not like that. It's like, yeah, you get very close to us as riders, but there still is that barrier between, like, the fans and the cyclists. Mm-hmm.
What's your vision on, I'm actually quite keen to talk to you about this, the way the Tour de France Femme avec Zwift has changed the game in the season. It feels like, maybe I'm flying the flag a bit too hard here, but it seems that maybe the Tour de France was the race that needed to really settle the women's professional racing to a different level. And it seems that pretty much it did this over the last couple of editions, and it changed the way other tours and other races are now tackling their own product and their own racing. Is that fair to say? Is it something that, as a professional cyclist, you also felt this way, or am I 100% wrong and I'm too French to admit this?
No, absolutely. You know, it's everybody knows the Tour de France is the biggest race in the world. It has been for a long time for the men. Like, yes, there are other big races. Yes, you have your one-day classics like Flanders, Roubaix. You have the other Grand Tours. But as a brand, Tour de France is the one race that everybody and anybody knows. And I felt that too. Like, the first year we had the official Tour de France Femme avec Zwift, you know, the amount of people who were engaging in me, like, you know, who know nothing about cycling, like, hey, good luck for the tour. You know, it's amazing, mm-hmm. like this and that. And we were always unsure how will it be being a separate race, because it's always like, do we need to piggyback off the men, or can we have our own platform and be as popular? And it really proved, like, even myself, I was surprised in the first year. Like, I knew in Paris we'd have huge crowds because obviously it was overlapped with the men. But continuing on, I wasn't expecting to have the crowds that we did. And, you know, it just shows how big the Tour de France is. And, you know, men or women, people want to go out there. They want to support it. They want to see it. And for teams as well, like, you know, it's a race everyone marks and says, we want our best team there. We want to make a selection. We want to have our lead riders preparing 100% for that race. Because also for sponsorship and things like that, they know if you get a good result there, like even as a team, that's what the sponsors want. And then that's what brings money into the sport. Like, it's unfortunate it's only one race where it's like that. Yes, okay, everybody looks at all the other races, but Tour de France has this kind of, I don't know, it's just that little bit bigger than the rest of cycling. And yeah, for sure, it's made other events step up. And, you know, we have seen more events putting women on equal footing to the men, looking to say, okay, should we separate? Should we stay together? How do we manage it? And bringing it closer to the men as well on time schedules as well. So it is, everybody sees both sides, but you are still seeing the crowds coming to see the women, which for me, when I've started on the professional level, is since like 2008, where women's cycling was not even known, you know, to see how big it's become. It's really nice, you know, to see we can actually inspire like young girls to actually get into cycling. It's pretty cool.
Did you believe when you were growing up on the bike in the hills of Adelaide as a little Tiffany that one day you could ride the Tour de France, you could ride a Paris Roubaix, you could ride all those races that were, you know, that just carry this mythical approach about 100 years history, survived the two world wars. I mean, they, you see the pictures from the so-called ancient times in the earlier part of the 20th century, and you just don't realize how large and how deep. The depth you have in the history of the race. You as a little girl, when you were 8, 9, 10, picking up your first bike, your first races and so on, that one day you could compete for that yellow jersey. You could compete for that cobblestone. You could be there.
Yeah, I would say probably not, because, you know, we just didn't have those races. Like, okay, already coming from Australia, like, we don't have the history of cycling as you do in Europe, where, you know, it is everywhere. So when I first started cycling, actually, I didn't know much about the sport. I knew Tour Down Under. But beyond that, it was like, okay, it wasn't until I started competing a bit more. And then, yes, you hear of the Tour de France, but the rest I hadn't really even heard of. So, and even like the top professional women, I didn't really know. Like, yes, you start to hear about like Sarah Carrigan when she won gold in Athens, or, you know, Noni Wood was a trailblazer. But for me, it was like, okay, I was looking up to Stuart O'Grady or Robbie McEwen, because those were the names you heard about. But obviously, yeah. I still remember, you know, in the early years when we had Tour Down Under, I was like, I would love to be able to race this race, but there was never the chance. And also when I went to Paris the first year to see the Tour de France, I think it was also like around 2010, mm-hmm. and I saw them riding on the Champs-Élysées, and you know the feelings you get, like the goosebump feelings. And I was like...
And the roar, like the roar, you're hearing the roar, the crowd, the, yeah. everything.
I was like, to me, I was just seeing, I was like, I wish we had that opportunity. And, you know, you just... could never really dream it, because there wasn't that, you know, there was never really the support behind it. There was always like the conversations, yes, there needs to be Women's Tour de France, blah, blah, blah. But at the higher level, they weren't getting behind it. So obviously now we see it, and now, yes, you can dream it. But I think I never really dreamed, because you could see there wasn't really the feeling that there was a belief there was going to ever be women's versions of these races.
Mm-hmm. And if we just divert a little bit on your team, on where you are at, it's a very young team. So you're therefore, and no ageism here, but you're probably seen as a mentor to the younger riders. How do you tackle that role? How do you take this on and bring the wealth? And I don't mince my word here, the wealth of experience that you have on the bike, Tiffany. How do you bring this to the young girls and to the young riders?
Yeah, obviously with Canyon Shram, I have been there a long time. And yes, I have had a very long career. And yeah, we do have a very young team, particularly this year. And it is interesting because, you know, obviously I've changed a lot as a rider, my roles throughout the years with the team. But I think initially I struggled a little bit with that kind of mentor role. Not that I didn't know I had the knowledge. It takes a lot before I feel the confidence where I can kind of play that leadership role in kind of giving back. But yeah, it's more just about being there for the girls, you know, like giving them when I see certain things, particularly off the bike, to just give them advice here and there. And, or if they ask me questions, to also give them advice. Like within the race, it's quite easy because then it's just second nature. It's like, I know what we need to do in a bike race. Then I'm very good at just kind of watching and observing and then being like, hey, you know, stop wasting so much energy in the wind or come with me and I'll help you through the bunch. So it's just kind of being proactive and engaging with my teammates and just not being too over the top or too in their face, because also I think that sometimes it can just be annoying and it's also not my style. It's more just knowing when the time is right where I need to give some advice or give my voice for, you know, things that we can do better within the bike race. And yeah, just trying to be a support and trying to help let them learn from the mistakes I've made along the way so then they don't make the same mistakes, you know, whether it's overtraining or not fueling yourself correctly or, you know, getting a bit lost in the ups and downs that come with cycling. Like, yeah, I just try to just be there if they need me, basically.
That's good. That's a good attitude. And but certainly the way you were taught riding and racing, I guess, more than anything has changed, I guess, because a lot of the young riders, they jump on Zwift, they jump on platforms like this, they do the watts, but they not do necessarily the, you know, the shoulder to shoulders or a bit less. Is that different how you learn racing? And do you see when you are sitting in a peloton, do you feel the peloton reacts differently because the behavior might be a bit different or not really?
No, it's definitely changed a lot. And even, you know, like firstly, there's so much more technology available. And yes, yeah, it's been so much more focused, like all about powder weight, carbs, all sorts of things. So like, you know, if we wind back when I started, it was like we had a CAD-I computer and you have speed and heart rate was a big thing when it first came in. Like there wasn't even power meters. I've been fortunate I came through the national program, the AIS, and, you know, they've always been ahead of the curve with research and bringing in new ways. Like we were already using SRM power meters like when they first were like the only one on the market. So from my side, yes, I have had a lot of discipline in terms of the education from a young age, but it wasn't, you know, we didn't have all the different data things you have today. Like now we have core sensors, we have, you know, obviously the power meters, we have
Strava, even just Strava, how you compare yourself to everybody else. And
yeah, we have Zwift, which, you know, I remember it's like, okay, I've always hated going on the trainer, but sometimes you have to. Or it's like some training sessions, you'll do ergo sessions, but it's like you look at your little computer or you look at a brick wall or you turn on a movie. It was like there weren't things like Zwift, which has made indoor cycling a lot more, I'd say, well, for some people they love it. For me, it makes it much more bearable. It gives me like more interaction, you know, and you can push yourself. It's like, okay, I'm going to chase that KOM because it's on my screen. So I'd say all of those sorts of things. For sure, with the level and the style of racing has also changed dramatically. Like I think the level is higher and higher all the time. Like when I was first starting, you could be an individual rider without a team and win everything. Like look at Marianna Vos. Like she still wins. She's still incredible. Yeah. But, you know, I've gone through my elite years pretty much the same as her. And, you know, she would win everything. She never had the strongest team, but she could win everything. Whereas if the sport was as it is now back then, she wouldn't be able to do that as an individual. Like, you know, even as the strongest rider, I'd say that's one of the biggest changes. It's like before, the emphasis on teamwork, playing different team roles wasn't as big, whereas now it's like everybody has their role. You need a strong team and the right tactics to then be able to deliver the results. So I think that's also something the younger riders now need to learn. Whereas when I came through, it's kind of, you work a lot out for yourself and yeah, you could get a good result, you know, if you have a good day. Whereas it's like these days you can have the best form. And if you're doing like a job, let's say leading into a climb or something like this, you're probably not going to go beyond that because the level is just so high.
Yeah. This year is an Olympic year, of course, 2024 Paris. So there's three spots for Australia. So where are your hopes? What do you want to do? Do you absolutely want to be there? You've embraced the Olympic spirit before. You want to be there, and it's not your hometown Olympics, but it's pretty much not far from it. And how would that be different for you to be in an Olympics in pretty much? I know you. Monaco is not France, but it's almost is. It's only a couple of hours, you know, or 3 hours on the train or whatever. But how different would that be, and how badly do you want to be there?
Of course, you know, we always dream to be at the Olympics. We always want to make the team. Like, this is my fourth Olympic cycle, and yeah, I've been through all the roller coasters of emotions like that comes with trying to get selected. Mm-hmm. And you know, I had so many almost there with both London and Rio, and then finally making the team in Tokyo, which, you know, it's still one of my proudest achievements I've had in sport, because, you know, I think it's every athlete's dream to be able to represent mm-hmm. their nation trying to chase gold at the Olympic Games. 100% Paris, it's always, any Olympics, I'm, you know, always want to put my hand up. And, yeah, I look at the course in Paris, it's exciting, it's technical, it's, you know, short, punchy climbs. It suits what I know is my strengths as a rider. But I'm also realistic. Like, the level of Australian women's cycling right now is quite high. We have, you know, a number of riders vying for those spots. Like, effectively, it's two spots because, you know, with Grace Brown, she's proved, you know, on the time trial with two times medals at the last two World Championships. Like, she'll be obviously focusing on that time trial spot. And, yeah, so, of course, I'd love to say yes, I want to be there, but I also just need to, yeah, be realistic. I'm doing what I can, like, in these next races to show I can be there and I can deserve a spot, but ultimately we just have to see how the classics go, see, you know, how I am comparative to the other riders we have who could be selected, and, yeah, just see what the selectors say. So I've kind of learned to take a step back and not put all my eggs in that basket and put the pressure on myself, because then, yeah, you could, at least when I did that once, I crumbled a bit. So it's kind of just taking a bit more relaxed approach, going into each race as I would always, and not trying to think too far ahead. But, you know, naturally, like, to get selected would be amazing. And, you know, to race in Paris, like, so close to Monaco, where, you know, it is definitely closer than Rio and Tokyo. And, but yeah, let's see. Like, as I said, it's been sort of a goal, but yeah, obviously these yeah. next 2 months count a lot with how the racing goes.
Do you feel you matured a lot in the last few years?
Yeah. I would agree. And yeah, I've learned to, well, I've always been a calm person, but not stress over the little things so much.
The next few months for you, classics, it's always an important part of your season, I guess. What would be for you an amazing classic season? If I can, you know, I've got a magic stick, I give you what you want here. What do you want?
To win a race would be amazing. Yeah. I'm realistic too. Like, I know these days what my role is within the team, and it is definitely playing the more support role in a team captain role. But yeah, obviously now we're in the classics period. The first two didn't go quite as I had hoped. Like, with Het Nieuwsblad, I crashed out on the cobbles and broke my thumb. So wasn't ideal, but luckily with a thumb, you can still ride your bike. So it only skipped one race. And then I'm hoping to put that behind me and now have the next races a lot cleaner and to be able to, yeah, be a bit better until the end of the race. So the goal is, you know, to be there when it counts. I want to be able to go deep into the races and to support my team, you know, right up until the business end. Like, that's for me is what I'll be happy with. I don't want to be like, okay, job's done as soon as the race gets hard. So I think that's what I'm striving for. I've been training well. The form is good. Roubaix, actually, the team have said for me to target that, which, even if you look at me as a rider, I'm small, so you wouldn't think I can be good in Roubaix, but in the women's...
Speaks in Roubaix. More than anything, I know you need the power, you need everything, but experience is a big, big, big part of doing well in that race.
experience and the ability to, like I say, box on, let's say. Yeah. It's always a race to the first sector. It's absolutely hectic. It's literally like you're on the limit of between crashing and not crashing. And it's actually one thing I'm actually very good at. Like I'm not afraid to put my elbows out and hold my ground. So I think, and that's what that race is about. It's like once you're in the first sector in a good place, it's already down to 30 riders. And then it's a game of getting through the best possible and be the last one standing. So they have given me the opportunity there as one of the riders to kind of target it. So definitely for me, I want to be able to embrace that because it's not often I get those opportunities. And yeah, if I can have a strong result at Roubaix, that would also be a very happy classics campaign.
Yeah, hashtag TIF for Roubaix.
Yeah, exactly.
I promised myself I was not going to talk about him, but just one question about Valtteri. Who wears the mullet better, him or Mathieu van der Poel? Tricky question.
I didn't even know van der Poel has a mullet.
Here we go. That's my answer. He has a mullet. No one has actually saw the whole full mullet. But he displayed a mullet. And that was quite an interesting point. Like Valtteri is proudly bearing the mullet, but there's sort of like Mitch Docker having a mullet. There's also, you know, so like, even if you don't picture it, who could wear it better?
I think Valtteri. I can't see Van der Poel with a mullet. He's too, I don't know, he's too clean cut. Whereas Valtteri's kind of embraced it. Like, yes, he has the mo. And he actually, as much as a mullet normally looks absolutely terrible, he kind of suits her. I don't know how, but he does.
Totally agree. Yeah. He doesn't make me want a mullet, but I'm happy he's got one and he looks good. And I'm happy to see him this weekend with a mullet here in Melbourne. Yeah. One last question and then we finish on this. But you've worked a lot on diverting what you do as well. You've invested or you created a gin called Oath. Can you tell us a little bit about the story and why a gin and what does that bring to you to be able to have this? And I will say this before you say it, but if you make a gin with red berries and stuff, please call it Bloody Oath.
To be fair, that Bloody Oath is in the pipeline. Not as a gin, but it's always been like when we come to Australia market, because we're still working on that with Oath, Bloody Oath is 100% in the marketing. but yeah, so... That project, it started as, so firstly, obviously, naturally, as you get on with your career, you start to think about, okay, how do I set myself up beyond my career? And I've always been, I'm someone who I can't sit still. I always need to do something. So, you know, whether it's, you know, I dabbled in trying to do fashion design and cycling apparel and this, and yeah, design is still one element of me, but then, yeah, all these other little projects here and there. And yeah, the gin came about because when Valtteri and I first met, it was always a drink we had if we wanted to have a drink. It was the one we shared together. And then it started with, okay, he's always traveling, I'm always traveling. So then we would try to find gins from wherever we were. So we literally have like about 150 gins at home, different ones from all over the world. And then it was just one day we're like, you know, we should make our own gin. So it kind of just started as that, but never really thought we would move forward with it. Then we're with some friends of ours who have some experience in alcohol startups. And they were like, yeah, we could help you with this. So then it just literally started like that. The four of us then partnered together and said, all right, let's do this. Then Valtteri, through his networks, had an opportunity or a contact with a distillery in Finland who were happy to make it for us. And, you know, so they're effectively just contract working to create the Oath Gin. And, yeah, it's just kind of gone from there. Like it's 100% passion project, but, you know, both of us are 100% involved, as you can probably see on all our socials. And yeah, it's always slow moving because, you know, we're not a big company. We've invested in it fully ourselves. Like we're not have a ton of money behind us to, you know, to move things faster. But, you know, it's kind of nice like that because we're building it step by step, trying to like open the market to wherever we can. And since then, it's then branching off to these different things. Like we've been doing a little bit of hospitality at the F1, like we have the one in Australia, the Oath Lounge, and that's kind of both to showcase a product and to bring people closer to Valtteri sport. Maybe we'll do that within cycling one way or another. Like we have the men's Tour de France final stage starting in Monaco. So for that, it makes sense to do something with Oath. So it just kind of went from there. And the story is definitely to represent both of us. It's like a mixture of Australia and Finland. Like Valtteri's family, they have some farms and they produce oats and the gin's distilled with oats, which makes it super smooth. And then I'm from the Adelaide Hills where apples are quite popular. There's a lot of apple orchards. So then we utilize that flavor profile and say, you know, it's inspired by the apples from where I've grown up. So it's all about something that's connected directly to us as well. Yeah. And that's the whole story. And yeah, that's kind of how it is. And, you know, we will look to potentially grow it into other things under the Oath brand. But yeah, watch this space.
Absolutely. Thank you. It's been lovely talking to you. Thank you for sparing the time. And best of luck for the classic seasons. And hopefully we'll see you on the, I personally see you on the roads of the Tour de France. It will be good.
Yes, hopefully. And yeah, thanks for the time and thanks for having me.